The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, C-Realm Vault subscribers. Welcome to episode number 116 of the C-Realm Vault podcast. This is the podcast that I had planned to put out before going to the Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth teach-in, and instead I'm putting it out afterwards. So because I'm putting it out late, you're going to get a little piece of that conference. First up, you're going to hear me talking with Mark Rabinowitz. Mark has been a guest on the C-Realm before, and he flew into New York City from Oregon to attend this conference. Then you will hear a bit of an address that President John F. Kennedy gave before the United Nations, in which he proposes making the race to the moon, or the project of sending humans to the moon, a cooperative effort with the Soviet Union. And finally, you will hear Douglas Rushkoff's presentation at the Techno-Utopianism Conference. So I won't have a lot to say. All the recorded material comes to about an hour. So here we go. I'm here at the kitchen table with Mark Rabinowitz of oilempire.us. He is in New York for the Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth Conference. Mark, welcome to the C-Realm Vault.
Thank you again for the opportunity and for the hospitality.
So you just finished listening to this week's C-Realm podcast, where I talked to Richard Heinberg about his back and forth with Paul Krugman, although Paul Krugman never mentions Richard by name, as far as I know. What thoughts came to mind as you listened to that?
Post-Carbon Institute and Richard Heinberg should be honored to be singled out for abuse by the king of the greenwashing economists at the New York Times. All the news that fits, we print. The categories. And to be attacked reminds me of the Gandhi quote, first they ignore you, then they attack you, and then you win. So I guess we have evolved from being ignored by the mainstream media to now being singled out for abuse. And the most hilarious aspect of the whole thing was to compare Post-Carbon Institute to the Koch brothers. I don't even know the words to describe how ridiculous that is. Post-Carbon Institute could not be more different than the Koch brothers, and to be lumped together suggests a desperation in trying to hold to a narrative that is falling apart, the narrative that we can have endless growth on a finite planet, we can give up fossil fuels without impact, we can have the techno-utopia future without using up the world's resources. Now, this is a very Disney view of the world, and it would be nice if it was true, but there's absolutely no evidence that it is true. One discussion in part of this was the idea that fossil fuels are, of course, one of the impacts on climate change, but in our lifetime, the world's forests have been cut down almost in half, and deforestation is an enormous contributor to climate change and the disruption of the hydrologic cycle that does not get nearly as much attention as carbon from sequestered fossil fuels. There's also, we are here in New York City, where there's an enormous amount of concrete all over the place, which has an impact on the climate pattern, which is not that well understood, but it's there. We're at one of the main harbors for an enormous port, which used to have a big fishery. And the fish supply of the world is dropping dramatically. Numbers are hard to pin down, but clearly we are stripping the world of fish. So if we switched over to solar-powered everything tomorrow, would that just enable us to strip the world of the last trees and the last fish and other resources that are, quote, renewable, but we are using faster than nature can regenerate?
When we finish this conversation, I'm going to be going to a yoga class, and I think you're going to be going to Ground Zero, where the 9/11 attacks, at least the ones with the most visible impact, occurred. What's your aim in going there?
Well, I haven't seen it since before it happened. I lived in New York City for the first couple of years of my life, but left as a small child. And despite the deep politics aspect of the 9/11 attacks, some of which I agree with and some I don't, I'm going to honor the memory of the victims of what happened there and to see it for myself, and partly just the spectacle that the lesson of 9/11, or one of the lessons of 9/11, seems to be ignored as they are building an even taller skyscraper there now, which I cannot imagine what it would be like for an office worker to work on the 67th floor in the New World Trade Center when it was probably the biggest target for every fanatical wingnut from Africa to East Asia who feels a need to strike violently at the United States. I certainly wouldn't want to work in there. I don't think you would want to work in there. And even without the potential for more violence there, these types of skyscrapers are incompatible with the reduced energy future that we are heading into. I went to hear James Kunstler speak last night, and he was talking about the difficulty in the required materials to construct these high-tech palaces as the long emergency kicks in a little bit more. And it's not only an issue of energy, it's also an issue of the very complex gaskets and other materials that are needed for these buildings to function. And they are enormous energy sinks, partly due to the logistics of the construction material and operating vast transportation systems to funnel people in from the hinterlands every day for work and many other aspects.
You saw Jim Kunstler speak at Cooper Union last night. Cooper Union is where we'll be going tomorrow for the Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth conference. What is it about that conference which motivated you to fly from one coast to the other to attend?
Well, this will be the third conference from International Forum on Globalization I've attended. The other two were world-class quality, and I expect this will be similar. There's a couple of speakers that I've heard a number of times before. And then there's a number of other speakers that I have never heard of before, let alone listened to before. And the synthesis of the different perspectives, not just peak oil and climate change and similar topics, but also the impacts of robotics and technologies to try to create things that are superior to 500 million years of evolution. These are all integrated together into a counter-narrative to the progress narrative that things are just going to get better and better and better no matter what. And I certainly wish that they would get better and better, but the evidence as it's come in over the last couple decades is contrary to that. There's going to be discussions of the impacts of nuclear technology on people. There's a Marshall Islander who will be speaking, and their story deserves as much attention as anybody else. There's discussion of trying to find ways to have genetics that are superior to evolution. I believe in evolution. I think evolution was a good idea. We should respect it. It doesn't mean it's always perfect, but the profit motive is probably not superior to the evolutionary trial and error over hundreds of millions of years. And inviting someone like Richard Heinberg to come and speak about PEAK is rather rare in most of the environmental movement. I've studied PEAK oil for almost three decades, and it has been quite surprising, even now that we're past global PEAK oil for conventional oil, that PEAK is still difficult to get environmental groups to discuss. For example, Bill McKibben will be speaking at this event, I believe tomorrow evening. And he obviously knows about PEAK, yet 350.org, his organization, is hesitant to even acknowledge this or to discuss the limits to growth, I see their analysis as actually closer to Paul Krugman's than Post-Carbon Institute. They want to just focus on the evils of fossil fuels, which are correct. But the reason we use fossil fuels is not that Exxon is greedy or Dick Cheney was not a nice person, but because fossil fuels are more concentrated than the alternatives.
You mentioned last night that you knew somebody who worked at Democracy Now! And that they tried for a long time to get Richard Heinberg on and that that was just not going anywhere. Would you repeat why you think that is?
I think the reason that Democracy Now! And most of the rest of the, quote, alternative media have been hesitant to discuss fossil fuel depletion is a combination of factors. It's much more fun to blame the fossil fuel companies for all of their problems that they've caused to the rest of us than to say, well, we're all part of the problem. Some are bigger than others. I don't think my footprint is the same as Dick Cheney's, but it's also not the same as someone in Liberia either. It's somewhere in between. And we've all played a role in this. That's not to exonerate the 0.001%, but we all live in some ways richer than medieval kings. Medieval kings did not get on airplanes and fly from one place to another or eat food that was grown on other continents other than maybe a rare treat that their navies found when they were out around the world. So we live like kings as middle-class people in America or in Europe or parts of Asia. And that's eating the world for our comfort. And that is a very disturbing thing to admit, self-included. And so rather than deal with that, it's much more fun to just point fingers. And we did a show a while back called Peak Blame, which is in the Sea Realm archives, which goes into this more. Plus, you also have the problem of innumeracy, the inability to do basic mathematics. And the idea that we actually have to think about the numbers of oil, if the only thing you want to think about oil or natural gas or coal or mineral ores or trees or fish or fresh water or anything else is that there's a certain amount of it, that there's exponential growth, which is not an easy thing for people to contemplate. It's not generally taught in the schools unless you go deep into math. The idea that we have to think about the rate of use and the rate of depletion of something that most people would just rather think of, well, that's just evil and I'm not going to think about it, that's not very helpful. Because it would be as if you had a bank account and you thought, well, money is the root of evil, so I'm not going to worry if I'm running out of money in my bank account. You might spend your bank account to the point that you didn't have one anymore. And we are drawing down nature's bank account, which is the only one that really matters for the future of life.
You mentioned that the people assembled at Cooper Union starting tomorrow, people like Vandana Shiva, Bill McKibben, Kirkpatrick Sale, people like that, they articulate a counter-narrative to the techno-utopian narrative. Do you give... as Nicole Foss would say, uncomplicated support to that counter-narrative, or do you have some quibbles with it?
Well, I'm certainly a supporter of the counter-narrative. The problem with it, the biggest problem, is why has it not happened?
What's it?
The alternative ecotopia, post-carbon paradise, whatever term you want to put on it, why has this not happened despite decades of conferences and reports and obvious conclusions that we cannot live the way we are living on the Earth? Unsustainable does not mean it is a bad idea. It means it cannot continue. And eating the Earth faster and faster, it worked well for a while if you ignore the inequities and abuses in the process, which obviously we are as a society. But it can't continue anymore. We have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet. And that is at the root of why the economic system, based on exponential growth, is no longer functioning, even for the people who are the beneficiaries of it, as opposed to the peons who are the serfs, our modern serfs, who keep the whole thing running. The powers that be, the smarter ones of them, have looked at the implications of reaching the limits to growth for decades, and they are ahead of most of the environmental groups, most of the social critics who point out the inequities of the abusive economic relations that we have set up over the last century and a half of the fossil fuel era, and how to switch from that predatory disaster capitalism to a smaller steady state economy is one of the great challenges of the era. I think some of the people at this conference understand this very well, and some may be reacting more to the symptoms that we suffer with, but the symptoms are only part of the problem. The social justice narrative is, of course, a key part of the story. But I'll say something quite controversial. I think it is a secondary part of the story, not the primary one. The primary one is the physical reality and the capacity of the biosphere. Within that, we need to think about how to share a shrinking planet, metaphorically. But we could also have a neo-feudalism global police state where our rulers are able to keep the system going, keep their role as the top dog going, while the rest of us toil in the shit down below. That's obviously not what we would like to see, but that does seem to be the approach of the system to try to manage. I don't think that will work in the long run, and I certainly don't support that. But the alternative is going to be even more difficult, because it will require the social justice advocates to understand that we cannot have a socialist utopia that involves socialist growth as opposed to capitalist growth. We need to transcend the idea of growth in order to have a steady state economy that's going to live on our solar budget. I've used photovoltaics, solar electricity, for almost 24 years now, and it's great, but it's not going to replace our current consumption, pun intended. We could have a nice future for our grandchildren, but it's not going to involve rocket ships to Mars and everybody with their flying car and more consumption and mile-high skyscrapers and all the rest. We're going to have to learn from nature that an ecosystem requires energy input when you take energy out. It requires understanding there's only so much abundance that the Earth has. The Earth is extremely abundant, but it is not infinite, as the fishermen off the Atlantic coast found out generations ago. There's only so much you can take. Even renewable resources require regeneration. And since we have drawn down nature's store of resources, the ones that can be renewed, we need to give them a breather in order to let them rebound at least a little bit. Of course, our population at 7 billion and climbing is one of the real wild cards here, and probably the most difficult aspect of the whole crisis to approach.
So you say that the inclusion of people like Richard Heinberg and also John Michael Greer will be at the event tomorrow, that the inclusion of these voices represents an expansion of the counter-progress narrative, one that starts to take biophysical realities into account. Would you like to see another expansion of that narrative, which takes what you call deep politics into account?
Well, deep politics is a term, I believe it was coined by the writer Peter Dale Scott in California, and it refers to the actual structures of government that operate beneath the surface, beyond public scrutiny, the so-called intelligence agencies, the financial connections, and similar entities which are not subject to the ballot box, but in many ways have more power, at least on certain aspects of the way things work, than the politicians and other above-the-surface institutions. It's like the part of the iceberg that is below the water. You don't see it, but don't run your boat into it. And there's a lot of evidence that the powers that be in these institutions, in the intelligence agencies, have looked at the limits to growth, have looked at peak oil, have looked at the impact that we've done to the environment. They've done this better than a lot of the environmental groups have done. And they're ahead, they're several steps ahead of the rest of us in terms of the response. It's not a compassionate and a cooperative response. It's not a response that we would agree with, but it is a response nevertheless. It's their transition approach. It's not transition town where we all work with our neighbors to make community gardens and set up bicycle co-ops and all the rest. It is instead, we're going to invade the Middle East oil fields, we're going to grab resources, we're going to intervene to grab African minerals and all the rest. It's an unpleasant approach, but it is what is underway. For us to be effective globally in a transition that is more compassionate and cooperative, we would need these institutions to be part of the solution instead of the part of the problem, to use a cliche. Dick Cheney was on record, for example, before becoming vice president, talking about peak oil in some detail. This did not get much attention in the media, but it showed that he was extremely aware of the problem, and his response was not to spend billions on Amtrak or relocalizing food. It was to invade Iraq and grab the oil. It's like the old joke about the bank robber who was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. Why did we invade Iraq? That's where the oil is. There was an article a couple days ago in the Boston Globe that surprised me in a very positive way. It was from a political scientist who was talking about why Obama has been identical to the Bush-Cheney administration when it comes to the, quote, intelligence agencies. And the author offered the concept of double government, that we have two governments. We have the overt government and the covert government. And the covert government is top dog when it comes to these important topics. And Obama has his own pedigree with his youthful employment by a Central Intelligence Agency front here in New York City right after graduating from Columbia College. So the three-letter agencies, the national security states of America, they have been studying the resource conflicts probably for half a century, maybe longer. It's incumbent on the rest of us who do not want this neo-feudalist response to these crises to accurately look at the amount of resources that, are left, and to try to figure out how we can have a compassionate power down that serves the human race and not just the people at the top of the skyscrapers.
I'm reporting an impression here. This is not data-driven at all, but the impression I get is that, for the most part, people who take a very active interest in the events of September 11th, 2001, typically do not do themselves any favors in terms of their own quality of life and do absolutely nothing to challenge the current power structures, and often get led down into absurd rabbit holes of utter fantasy, which really divorces them from reality. And it strikes me that somebody, say, holding up a placard at out front of Cooper Union tomorrow with something about 9/11 on it would be unwelcome by most of the conference participants and speakers, and I would think probably with good reason. And my previous question to you was meant to ask, do you think there is any benefit to be had by introducing notions of deep politics, and particularly the iconic images of deep politics, say, you know, the Twin Towers coming down, into this discussion? Or would that just muddy the waters in an unhelpful fashion?
Well, unfortunately, as we've discussed in the past, the topics of what happened on 9/11 have been so misdirected and wrecked by absurd science fiction fantasies and nonsense that it is a radioactive topic nearly everywhere. It is the real third rail of politics. It's not Social Security, it's deep politics. Nevertheless, the fact that there was more than sufficient foreknowledge to stop the attacks, and yet they were allowed to happen anyway, is part of the dysfunctional political system that we live in. I actually think at this point, a better place to start the discussion is 51 years ago with President Kennedy trying to turn off the Cold War and end the arms race and being removed from office for it. And our political system never recovered from this. There's certainly plenty of people in politics who understand that this is the reality. In fact, the Kennedy family, from day one, understood that this was the fact of what had happened. Yet they chose to cover it up, perhaps for their own safety, perhaps to be politically accepted in the mainstream media culture. It's little known that Robert Kennedy Jr., about 2 years ago, finally came clean and said their family never believed the Warren Commission report. Now, the reason this is important is not to obsess over the micro details of what happened during the assassination of President Kennedy, but the real issue is what his administration was trying to do, which was to change American foreign policy and priorities and to call off the Cold War, to convert the resources for endless war to peaceful purposes. Where would the environmental crisis be today if the war in Vietnam had ended in 1965, if the nuclear arms race had ended in Kennedy's second term? Would we have used those resources for other things? Would we have spent the trillions and trillions of dollars on things that met human needs instead of more bombs and weapons? How big would the nuclear waste stockpiles be if nuclear weapons production ended in the mid-60s? Where would the climate crisis be if we had used those resources to build a national train network for moving people around? Where would our political system be if assassination was not a tool of enforcing political change? Where would the Democratic Party be? Where would the Republican Party be? Would you ever have heard of the Bush family?
I know you have some bits of audio of President Kennedy speaking, which would back up the claims that you're making, and that these bits of audio are conspicuously absent from the public narrative about President Kennedy. If I could close this conversation with one of those clips, what would we be listening to and what would that illustrate?
My favorite one is the speech that President Kennedy gave to the United Nations on September 20, 1963. I have the whole thing online at jfkmoon.org. And it was his second and final speech to the General Assembly. And in there, he called off the Cold War and the arms race. He had just signed the nuclear test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. And midway through the speech, he offered to convert the moon race to a global cooperative effort for a joint moon landing with the Soviet Union, partially as a detente building exercise, and partially if you merge the rocket programs of the two sides, it's much harder to have a nuclear war with rockets. And this was less than a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest we have come to global nuclear annihilation. And if that crisis had not been defused successfully, we would not be sitting here in New York City, because New York City would be a giant hole in the ground. And what the world would look like is anyone's guess, but it would be fortunate if any humans had survived that nuclear war.
Well, let's listen to that now. And Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Today we may have reached a pause in the Cold War, but that is not a lasting peace. A test ban treaty is a milestone, but it is not the millennium. We have not been released from our obligations. We have been given an opportunity. And if we fail to make the most of this moment and this momentum, if we convert our newfound hopes and understandings into new walls and weapons of hostility, if this pause in the Cold War merely leads to its renewal and not its end, then the indictment of posterity will rightly point its finger at us all. But if we can stretch this pause into a period of cooperation, if both sides can now gain new confidence and experience in concrete collaborations for peace, if we can now be as bold and far-sighted in the control of deadly weapons as we have been in their creation, then surely this first small step can be the start of a long and fruitful journey. The task of building the peace lies with the leaders of every nation, large and small, for the great powers have no monopoly on conflict or ambition. The Cold War is not the only expression of tension in this world, and the nuclear race is not the only arms race. Even little wars are dangerous in a nuclear world. The long labor of peace is an undertaking for every nation, and in this effort, none of us can remain unaligned. To this goal, none can be uncommitted. The reduction of global tension must not be an excuse for the narrow pursuit of self-interest. If the Soviet Union and the United States, with all of their global interests and clashing commitments of ideology, and with nuclear weapons still aimed at each other today, can find areas of common interest and agreement, then surely other nations can do the same. Nations caught in regional conflicts, in racial issues, or in the death throes of old colonialism. Chronic disputes which divert precious resources from the needs of the people or drain the energies of both sides serve the interests of no one. And the badge of responsibility in the modern world is a willingness to seek peaceful solutions. It is never too early to try, and it's never too late to talk. And it's high time that many disputes on the agenda of this assembly were taken off the debating schedule and placed on the negotiating table. The fact remains that the United States, as a major nuclear power, does have a special responsibility to the world. It is, in fact, a threefold responsibility: a responsibility to our own citizens, a responsibility to the people of the whole world who are affected by our decisions, and to the next generation of humanity. We believe the Soviet Union also has these special responsibilities, and that those responsibilities require our two nations to concentrate less on our differences and more on the means of resolving them peacefully. For too long, both of us have increased our military budgets, our nuclear stockpiles, and our capacity to destroy all life on this hemisphere, human, animal, vegetable, without any corresponding increase in our security. Our conflicts, to be sure, are real. Our concepts of the world are different. No service is performed by failing to make clear our disagreements. A central difference is the belief of the American people in self-determination for all people. We believe that the people of Germany and Berlin must be free to reunite their capital and their country. We believe that the people of Cuba must be free to secure the fruits of the revolution that have been betrayed from within and exploited from without. In short, we believe that in all the world, in Eastern Europe as well as Western, in Southern Africa as well as Northern, in old nations as well as new, that people must be free to choose their own future without discrimination or dictation, without coercion or subversion. These are the basic differences between the Soviet Union and the United States, and they cannot be concealed. So long as they exist, they set limits to agreements, and they forbid the relaxation of our vigilance. Our defense around the world will be maintained for the protection of freedom, and our determination to safeguard that freedom will measure up to any threat or challenge. But I would say to the leaders of the Soviet Union and to their people that if either of our countries is to be fully secure, we need a much better weapon than the H-bomb, a weapon better than ballistic missiles or nuclear submarines, and that better weapon is peaceful cooperation. We have in recent years agreed on a limited test ban treaty, on an emergency communications link between our capitals, on a statement of principles for disarmament, on an increase in cultural exchange, on cooperation in outer space, on the peaceful exploration of the Antarctics, and on tempering last year's crisis over Cuba. I believe, therefore, that the Soviet Union and the United States, together with their allies, can achieve further agreements, agreements which spring from our mutual interest in avoiding mutual destruction. There can be no doubt about the agenda of further steps. We must continue to seek agreements on measures which prevent war by accident or miscalculation. We must continue to seek agreement on safeguards against surprise attack, including observation posts at key points. We must continue to seek agreement on further measures to curb the nuclear arms race by controlling the transfer of nuclear weapons, converting fissionable materials to peaceful purposes, and banning underground testing with adequate inspection and enforcement. We must continue to seek agreement on a freer flow of information and people from east to west and west to east. We must continue to seek agreement, encouraged by yesterday's affirmative response to this proposal by the Soviet foreign minister on an arrangement to keep weapons of mass destruction out of outer space. Let us get our negotiators back to the negotiating table to work out a practicable arrangement to this end. In these and other ways, let us move up the steep and difficult path towards comprehensive disarmament, securing mutual confidence through mutual verification, and building the institutions of peace as we dismantle the engines of war. We must not let failure to agree on all points delay agreements where agreement is possible, and we must not put forward proposals for propaganda purposes. Finally, in a field where the United States and the Soviet Union have a special capacity in the field of space, there is room for new cooperation, for further joint efforts in the regulation and exploration of space. I include among these possibilities a joint expedition to the moon. Space offers no problems of sovereignty. By resolution of this assembly, the members of the United Nations have forsworn any claim to territorial rights in outer space or on celestial bodies, and declared that international law and the United Nations Charter will apply. Why, therefore, should man's first flight to the moon be a matter of national competition? Why should the United States and the Soviet Union, in preparing for such expeditions, become involved in immense duplications of research, construction, and expenditure Surely we should explore whether the scientists and astronauts of our two countries, indeed of all the world, cannot work together in the conquest of space. Sending someday in this decade to the moon, not the representatives of a single nation, but the representatives of all of our countries. All these and other new steps towards peaceful cooperation may be possible. Most of them will require, on our part, full consultation with our allies, for their interests are as much involved as our own, and we will not make an agreement at their expense. Most of them will require long and careful negotiation, and most of them will require a new approach to the Cold War, a desire not to bury one adversary, but to compete in a host of peaceful arenas in ideas and production, and ultimately in service to all mankind. The contest will continue. The contest between those who see a monolithic world and those who believe in diversity. But it should be a contest in leadership and responsibility instead of destruction. A contest in achievement instead of intimidation. Speaking for the United States of America, I welcome such a contest. For we believe that truth is stronger than error, and that freedom is more enduring than coercion. And in the contest for a better life, all the world can be a winner.
So I'm honored to be here, especially among some of my my personal idols. I wish it was under better circumstances. We're not here celebrating the triumph of humanity, but fears of what we're going to do. I've been working a long time on trying to figure out a way to parse, to separate the effects of technology from the effects of our society itself, our values. In other words, there are these technologies, and while I don't think technologies are neutral, I think that they're, some of them are kind of cool, yet there's this future that we seem to be building with them, or this way that we're using them, that's a little upsetting, you know, and it's real easy to just get lumped in, oh, you're one of those tech hater people, Luddite, horrible, red, whatever, red maybe, but the other stuff, I'm not so sure. And then just a year or two ago, I was having a television moment where I got great clarity on what the problem is. And it was while I was watching with my wife this show called The Real Housewives of Orange County. And many of you probably, you know, you're not TV people, so you may don't know this show. It's from a genre called reality TV, which pretends to be about these real people in these situations. And The Real Housewives of Orange County is a show about these, you know, women kind of in their 40s and 50s who have meals together and have misunderstandings and then big fights. And I watched this show over a period of really a year or two, and from the perspective of a media theorist, which is what I am, a communications theorist, and I was trying to understand, why are these women having so many misunderstandings, right? Is it because, you know, they get paid better, the show gets better ratings, if they're fighting? You know, maybe, but these are women from, you know, the same socioeconomic background, the same age, they speak the same language, they live in the same region, they wear the same clothing. They should, by all accounts, have more rapport, have better communication rather than worse. And then what I realized was that these women's, their faces don't move appropriately to the things they're expressing. That these women, they've had so much plastic surgery and inject so much Botox into their faces that they can't make facial expressions that are consonant with the things they're saying. And so then there are these big misunderstandings. Like one of them says, oh, you know, my daughter is going in tomorrow for cancer testing. And then the other one says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And then they talk to the first one later, and she says, I don't think she really cared. She didn't seem to be, she that she cared. And from my perspective, what's going on here is a classic misapplication of technology. Right? These women are using state-of-the-art plastic surgery, Botox tools in order to try to lock their faces down at age 29. And in doing so, they're making themselves unavailable to the moment that they're actually in. But they have these two different understandings of time, which the Greeks understood. One is called chronos, which is time on the clock. Right? What time did you crash the car? I crashed the car at 4:01. Right? There's this other time called kairos, which is a more of a human time, a kind of a readiness, the time that you actually live in. And what time do you tell Dad that you crashed the car? 4:17? No, you tell Dad you crashed the car after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills. Right? It's that kind of state of readiness or opportunity that only human beings can understand. And what these women have done is by trying to lock down Chronos at a certain moment, they've made themselves unavailable to Kairos, to their humanity, right? To the thing that actually makes them alive in the moment. Right? I think that this is the mistake we've made with digital technology. The simplest way that I experienced it was when the internet first happened, back in the well, whole earth, Mana 2000 era of the net. The internet was something that made more time for us. Right? The way you conversed in an online bulletin board was you would turn on your computer, you would log, you would plug it into a modem, it was old school. You'd have a modem, it would dial into a server, you would download the conversation, you'd disconnect from the net, and then you'd read the conversation in your own time. And there could be someone like Mike Winner on there, right? So you're gonna take your time before you respond. You take an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or all night, and you craft this perfect paragraph because you're gonna be participating with great minds, and you want to put your best foot forward. Then you log back in and you upload your paragraph or two of response, and perfectly edited zingers in there. You get it on there, and then you wait a day or two to see what people had to say about it. It was like chess by mail. And everybody sounded really smart on there because they did all that time shifting and time compression, because they used the net in the asynchronous stepped way that the net actually works. It's an asynchronous technology. It lives outside time. Email sits and waits for you. It's not like a phone that you have to answer in the moment, although now we have voicemail. So the internet was a place where people sounded smarter than they do in real life. Imagine that. And that's why people like me looked at the net and thought, wow, this is going to enhance humanity. This is going to augment what we can do. I can be smarter there than in real life because of my time compression. I can interact with smarter brains than I get to in real life because I can connect to the other nodes. But what did we do? You know, when the technology story really moved from the culture of human enhancement, from the kind of psychedelic, magical, Mondo 2000 world to the much more market-driven pages of Wired magazine, all of a sudden the internet was no longer a place that we were going to expand what it meant to be human. It was a place where we were going to save the NASDAQ stock exchange, which had been suffering since the biotech crash in 1987. So now these devices, these technologies, these applications had to somehow find a way to mine us for value, to extract value. We couldn't go to countries of little brown people and enslave them anymore, right? That colonization thing had stopped, and with it, the expansion of the economy seemed doomed. But we found a new territory in human attention, in human time. So we started to commodify, to mine human time for its value. And then the words that started to describe net development were things like stickiness and eyeball hours. Right. Wired magazine announced that we are living in an attention economy. We might have infinite real estate online, but there are only so many eyeball hours in a day. So the object of the game now was to extract those eyeball hours from people in terms of their attention. So we end up taking an asynchronous device like the internet and turning it into an always-on device like an iPhone. We strap the internet to our bodies and have the internet interrupt us every time someone does a Facebook update or tweets about us or sends an email or wants our attention or an app wants to tell us that something new is going on. And we live in a state of perpetual emergency interruption that the only people who endured that before this were 911 operators or air traffic controllers. And they did it for only 4 hours at a time, and they got drugs for it. And along with this, along with this state of constant interruption, we had the millennium, right? Like Dr. Winter was talking about. We had the Y2K bug, the seeming, you know, we were so leaning forward in the late 1990s and speculating towards the dot-com boom and the infinite expansion of the economy. This is going to be great. Don't worry. Invest, invest, invest. Have irrational exuberance. It's all okay. We're all leaning forward into the future. And then the year 2000 comes, and it's like, well, now what? No, the stock market crashed 2 months into the year 2000 because we were no longer leaning forward into the future toward the millennium, but we were all presentists. Right? We had the Y2K bug, but did the planes fall out of the sky? No, in spite of the fact that KLM grounded their fleet because they were afraid that planes were going to come down and the computers would figure out the changing year. It didn't happen. Even 2012 didn't happen. You know, what did happen was 9/11. What did happen was a sense of extreme discontinuity. This leaning forward that kept us in a kind of a narrative of an almost a triumphalist narrative collapsed. Right? We can't have a story anymore. Our stories don't work. We're not moving towards anything. We can't be goal-oriented, both because we're living in the constant interruption of digital media and because we've passed over a threshold. We've kind of gotten to Oz and are wondering now what. So when the narrative collapses, you know, we can't lean forward into anything. There's really two reactions to that. One is we move into crisis control, right? Look at government. What does government do now? It responds to crises. It doesn't have a plan. There's no narrative. There's no thing that we want. We're just in crisis control or in a panic state. So what we do to get over this fear, this inability to move forward, is we give ourselves speed. We kind of go on Ritalin, right, and try to recreate that story on steroids. You know, the political party, the religion. But those things, on a certain level, we can look at the collapse of narrative not as a bad thing that we need to correct, but as kind of a good thing, as an interesting thing, or at least an appropriate thing for this age of humanity. You know, no, I've never really liked movements. I mean, I think they were a great thing for the 20th century, but movements can be as much about great things as awful things. You know, one day we could be walking arm in arm with Martin Luther King down Fifth Avenue, you know, keeping our eyes on the prize, and the next we can be keeping our eyes on the prize as a way of justifying a whole bunch of awful acts. Well, if we just do these kind of terrible things, then we'll get to that. You know, every ism of the 20th century had the same goal-oriented journey in mind. You know, it's difficult because we can't rally people around the idea, oh, we're going to go and stick a flag in the moon, and then when we've done it, we did it, we got there, yay! You know, you can't rally people quite in the same way without that thing up there. But you can't rally people in quite the same way without that thing up there. You don't have people just marching behind a charismatic leader towards a goal they may not completely understand. And besides, I would argue that our problems today are not stick a flag in the moon, we won, victory is ours kinds of problems. You can't land on an aircraft carrier and say, we won. There is nothing to win. Our problems now are not problems that you win. These are ongoing, chronic concerns. I don't think they're fixable in some false future, but rather the problems of sustainability. You know, life is not something, oh, I solved life, now I'm just, what is that? Retirement? I solved life, I figured it out, I got the money, what did I do? It rings false to all of us, right? So instead of living these kind of book-like, movie-like lives, or going as a society towards some third act that we think, oh, that's when it's going to happen, that thing. You know, we start moving through life in a fashion in some ways more more consonant with video gaming, with digital gaming. You know, where instead of getting to some conclusion, we're making choices in real time. Instead of following some third character hero through his journey, we are that character making choices as we move towards what we think is better, towards our preferred future, or really our preferred present. No, it's the difference between football, which is a game with one team and another team, they fight, and there's a winner and a loser by the end of the game, and a fantasy role-playing game, where there's no winner or loser, there's no sides, really. A fantasy role-playing game, you don't play in order to win and end the game, you play in order to figure out how to keep the game going. Right? The object of one of those games, of what we call an infinite game, is how long can we play? How interesting can this be? How long can we sustain this game? Right? Which is a kind of place that seems much more relevant to a world that's not looking how do we win reality, but how do we keep reality going? You know, technologists should get this. But oddly enough, technologists and scientists and economists, they seem not to. You know, my peers, when I do most of these kind of panels, my technologists, they're all looking forward to the singularity, right? These are folks who can't bring themselves out of that 20th century or 13th century model of organizing the world. They still need to understand things as beginnings, middles, and endings. They still are so imprinted with the kind of the wrong lesson of Christianity, right? Which is that we're going to get to the end and have winners and losers, that there's some apocalypse, there's some moment to go towards that thing, the great orgasm at the end of time, when consciousness rises from matter. Right? They're focused on the singularity because they really want to transcend the human. Right? The singularity being the moment that technology surpasses us. And they believe that human beings at that point will only be valuable insofar as we can keep the machines going. But their understanding of the evolution of reality, really, is information is what is evolving towards greater states of complexity. So information first, it uses matter to get complex, then it uses biology, then it uses humans, and now information will use technology. It will use silicon. And we should shepherd it. Farewell, go, and be like Moses, and let information itself go into the land of Canaan without us. You know, something happened on the way from Mondo to Wired. On the way from Leary to Minsky, on the way from intelligence augmentation to artificial intelligence, where it was no longer about humans being in the center of this thing. And when I say that, they say to me, well, you just say that because you're a human. Like it's hubris or something. It's damn right I'm saying this. I'm a human. Of course, I am on Team Human. And I think it's okay to be on Team Human, especially if we're human. I do think human beings are special. But when I look at popular culture, what I see is the same kind of questioning about, are people special at all? You know, what is the zombie apocalypse, other than wish fulfillment for people who are just too tied to their phones? You know, it's a nice picture. You sit on a hilltop with a shotgun and get some slow-moving zombies, you got your family, you got your canned soup, and no electricity, no phones. But what is it beyond that? Beyond that, it's really asking us, what is the difference between a human being and a zombie, if anything? Right, we kill to eat, we walk around. I mean, they are us, and you always see those shots. You know, people are sort of looking at the zombies wondering, well, what's really the difference? We hunt, we kill, we hurt each other. There is a difference. There is a difference between people and zombies. People are alive. And even if we don't know the difference, that's mission enough to keep us going. What is life? What matters? What does it mean to be on Team Human. You know, we who live in the real world, I would argue, we have a home field advantage to the things that don't. You know, but and we who are on Team Human, looking for sustainable pathways for humanity to move forward, we are not the retro reactionaries. The reactionaries are the ones who are employing technology to somehow hold up the edifice of corporate capitalism. Right? There's not a coincidence that Kurzweil ends up at Google. Right? It's this thing. These are the folks who are trying to figure out how do we keep our valuations high? How do we keep the VC happy? How do we keep the market infinitely expanding? Right, the market infinitely expanding may not be the story we're looking at. The story we're looking at may be humanity sustaining itself in this contained biosphere. You know, the folks who are still addicted to Kronos, like those Real Housewives, you know, they are trying to lock down time in the 20th century. They're trying to lock down a banking system. They're trying to lock down a currency system. They're trying to lock down an expansionist model of society that requires more and more stuff in order to stay still. You know, Kairos, on the other hand, is for humans. The Kairos, the real time that people spend engaged with one another in the real world. And when we're doing that, when we're connected to other people in that space of Kairos and readiness, the systems can't actually touch us. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, that was Doug Rushkoff. You have heard him on the Sea Realm podcast before. I did get to speak to him briefly at the gathering, although he didn't stay long. And, well, it's quite likely that he'll be on the Sea Realm podcast again in the not-too-distant future. On the main Sea Realm podcast this coming Wednesday, you will hear two interviews that I recorded at the gathering on Sunday in Cooper Union. So I hope that you will join me for those. And until we next meet here in the vault, I hope that you will stay well.